Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, the bear, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee, Chicopee, Spirit Lake, Grand Lake, Devil's Lake, Crater Lake, the Beach Lake. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. You caught me sipping coffee. I'm sorry about that. But welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show, ladies and gentlemen. And tonight is a very special night. We've been talking about this for several weeks. Lucy has finally arrived in the United States, and because she's here as a worker, a professional worker with us for the first time, Lucy's going to do our blonde joke tonight. And remember, Lucy and Audrey are very good friends from London, England. So we're looking forward to that. Lucy, congratulations that you finally made it over here, and we could not be more pleased. Here you are again. We're listening to the Blog Talk Radio Network on the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I want to thank Johnny Cash again for taking us on that trip across 90 cities and states. And I saw today, I wonder if John has ever seen one of these, I saw today a tractor trailer wide load, overload, long load, with not one Highway Patrol cruiser leading or directing, not two, not three, but four. I kid you not, this load in length had to be, it was all red, red trucks, red equipment, red whatever was stacked on top of this thing. It had to be 7 full-length tractor trailer lengths. And I think the purpose of the extra cars was, if they ever have to turn, I think what happens is they stop, because this is like 6 trailers all linked together, that they probably have to disconnect and then get some of them around the corner, get everything, then reconnect and go on down the road. But I've never seen anything like that in my life. I wonder what the load was exactly. But 4 Highway Patrol officers here in the state of Ohio on Route 24 directing that little episode. First time, never seen anything like it. Okay, the purpose of the show is what it always is. We're trying to discuss news, issues, events, and developments or problems on the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. We dedicate the show to these tireless criminal justice courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals, even when we talk about them in a critical way. I mean, that's what education is about, right? Problems, issues, trends, how to resolve things, that sort of thing. We are indeed indebted to our criminal justice professionals. What we try to do is look inside criminal justice and then take a close-up look at the practicing professionals. You're on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Just remember that Alan Levy's the genius behind the medium. He's the CEO of BTR, and you can get your own show in probably about, I'm guessing, 7 minutes. Sign up, and what that permits you to do. Any person you want to work with, any political group, for example, if you have a message to talk about, then you can have a show and be signed up and broadcast worldwide and streaming audio for absolutely nothing, and you can broadcast to an unlimited number of listeners. Guess you got to be in the category of old coot when you go back far enough to remember in the 90s when this idea first started, you could broadcast, but you could listen to like, or 20 people could listen to you, or 50 people the most. Now it's an unlimited number of listeners. And I think on this switchboard, we could actually, on calls, I thought it said, we could actually bring on 50 people. We're not going to do that. Usually we bring on none anymore. So anyway, get your own show if you don't like that. Tonight's show we're going to do with something very interesting. We're going to have the, through Book TV, of course, we're going to have Susan Herman. She is the president of the American Civil Liberties Union. And she's going to be talking about her book, Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of American Democracy. I'm not saying that's a favorite theme of mine, but lovers of liberty love the Fourth Amendment the most, and the First Amendment is probably second, if not first, in some people's minds. But she's going to be talking about what's going on since 9/11 and some of the things that have happened that are more than just accidents in terms of liberties being taken away from people. She's going to be interviewed by Viet Dinh. He's a Georgetown Law professor, and he's a former Assistant Attorney General of the United States. I think you'll find this dialogue very interesting and important at this particular point of time. We can't justify everything because we fear terrorists. We can't justify every intrusion into our life. Now, I have a comment about that relative to the news stories in just a moment. Okay. If you're a listener and you want to call in during the news segment of the show and talk about some of these items, you can do that, and you can call in on your phone, and the number is 347-996-5983. It's 347-996-5983, and we'd be glad to speak with you. Audrey has a blonde joke tonight, but she has relinquished that joke to Lucy from London, England, and she's going to be doing our joke for us tonight. I think you have a series up, don't you, Lucy, one-liners? Right, we like those. We like those also, so go ahead and welcome again to our show. We are so glad that you're joining our staff, and you bring some valuable insights to the kind of work that we're doing. Lucy, go ahead.
Professor Haley and all of the other wonderful staff of the Jumbled Justice Radio Show, I want to thank you all for allowing me to join this team of insightful and highly motivated professionals.
Thank you.
Allow me to get right to the blonde jokes that Audrey is allowing me to do tonight. This is a series of one-line jokes, and I hope folks enjoy them a lot. There is something here for all. Did you hear about the blonde bat? Couldn't learn to water ski because she couldn't find a lake with a slope. Got excited because she finished her jigsaw puzzle in 6 months in the box bed, 2 to 4 years, but couldn't call 911 because there was no 11 on any phone button. When asked what the capital of California was, answered, D. Baked a turkey for 3 days because the instructions said 1 hour per pound and she weighed 125. After losing in a breaststroke swimming competition, complained that the other swimmers were using their arms.
Well, thank you very much, Lucy, and we look forward to your contributions in the future. And I understand you're actually going to be doing, not every week, but a little news segment for us with commentary, and we certainly look forward to that. It's the kind of work that you're used to doing. The Ohio Coalition Against Guns has a public service announcement they would like for us to play. We've been playing it every week since the show started because we think if this message gets out enough, that the criminals will hear this message that they shouldn't be carrying guns, and they'll go turn them in. Go ahead, Ohio Coalition.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Okay, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and we know it is a very deadly idea. And again, we hope that all the criminals will go ahead and turn in their firearms. All right. Next, we're going to look at a green tip, and we have an interesting one tonight that I don't think I've thought much about. We're trying to save the planet and global warming. You've probably noticed how much hotter and warmer it's gotten here recently. This is about water-powered batteries. I've never heard of these. This comes from Esma Floyd's little book, 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. And here's the tip. Always keep an eye on new inventions. On the market is a new water-based battery. You simply have to fill up with water every few months to keep it working. Ultimately, you may be able to choose these instead of relying on traditional alkaline batteries, which for such products as clocks and calculators. So you would have a water battery, I guess, next to, I don't know if it would go in your clock or your calculator or what, but that would supply the power. I wonder what it's like, Mike. Is it like a little waterfall? A little waterfall or what? Anyway, I'm going to look that one up. I've never heard of a water-powered battery before, but I don't get around much when it comes to a battery power. Okay. Thank you very much. Now, let's go ahead and take a look at some of these news stories, and some of these things are absolutely incredible tonight. And I'll mention some right off the bat that are stories that I can't believe. The Supreme Court yesterday heard a case about a guy. It's 6.5 years ago after a family outing turned into a week-long nightmare behind bars. Albert Florence is getting a Supreme Court hearing on his claim that authorities violated his constitutional rights when they twice made him to submit to strip searches in jail. The warrant, by the way, was for him not paying a traffic fine, which was paid. And he even had documents with him, apparently, that showed that he had paid it. And what he's saying, if they have no inclination whatsoever, not even a scintilla of evidence, I'm a drug dealer or carrying guns or hiding cell phones or whatever, this is a case of violating my human rights and my privacy being invaded. Should I be strip searched when I booked him to jail for a while, forced to undress and shower in front of guards? He calls it one of the most dangerous jails in New Jersey, is where this actually happened, Essex County Jail. And what do you think about that? Should Audrey, what do you think? Should he be strip searched for something like booked on a traffic warrant? Yeah, he's being put in the jail with other inmates, I guess. So that's the organization or the sheriff's department's pitch on this particular thing. Anyway, kind of an interesting idea. Here's one that we've talked about this subject more than once. Illegal immigration in the United States. Yes, there are a few that are actually in the United States illegally. But four people have been charged with visa fraud in a federal court in California, in Oakland. And this is part of a case against Tri-Valley University. And it's an alleged sham university accused of admitting foreign students so that they can remain in the United States on student visas while not requiring them to attend any classes. you sign up for the university, you get admitted, you pay your tuition, and you get a legal residency here, but you don't have to go to any classes. And they don't have exams and things like that. Isn't that neat? Interesting? So they finally caught up with this outfit. I wonder how many more of those are there around the United States. And it's going to be an illegal immigration issue. It's still off the burner. The candidates in these debates are talking about it a little bit, but my hunch is that the folks are going to walk away from this thing one more time. I could be wrong. If you live in Topeka, Kansas, good luck if something happens in your city. The city council announced the proposal October 4 after the Shawnee County District Attorney's Office said it could no longer prosecute misdemeanor cases.
including domestic violence. Except that the city is so busy that they can't do this. They're not able to respond to that. Now, let me tell you about St. Mary's, Georgia. I don't think we talked about that last week. Let me see the date on that. No, 10-10, we didn't. St. Mary's, Georgia is actually going to use prison inmates. The program would put two inmates in each of three existing firehouses in Camden County, Georgia. Isn't that interesting? The inmates would respond to all emergencies, including residential fires, alongside traditional firefighters. So the inmates, would have no guard, but would be monitored by a surveillance system. Oh, that's good. And the traditional firefighters who would undergo training to guard the inmates. So you get a little certificate after you go through a training session on how to guard inmates. I was joking about this in class today, saying that now if you have a fire in your house in St. Mary's, Georgia, and you call the fire department, be sure to lock your house before you leave, because you'll have prison inmates showing up to do the firefight. I've never heard of anything like that. Have you, Mike? Audrey? Lucy? I've never heard anything like that. I've heard them in some capacities working in the community, but never for the fire department. I wonder how the firefighters like that idea. I assume that they're interested in it. Who knows? Anyway, that's some of the things going on in the news, and I think we'll roll off of that right now and go on to our actual segment. And one of the things that happens in this particular story is that the president of the ACLU, she's tracked violations of civil rights, of course, for years. That's the prime purpose of the American Civil Liberties Union. And I think you will enjoy her very intelligent conversation about what's going on relative to the loss of civil liberty since 9/11. No one wants to be bombed, terrorized. We all concur with that. But it doesn't mean that they have a blank card for invading everyone's privacy on a regular basis. And anyway, I think you'll enjoy this. Give me a moment to set it up, and away we go. This will be Susan Herman, and she is the president of the American Civil Liberties Union and also a professor of law at Brooklyn Law College. And she's being interviewed by Viet Dan. He is a Georgetown law professor and former assistant attorney general for the United States. Coming up next, Hope TV presents Afterwards, an hour-long program where we invite guest hosts to interview authors. This week, Susan Herman and her new book, Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of American Democracy. In it, Ms. Herman asserts that anti-terrorism laws, such as the Patriot Act, have damaged the lives of many citizens. The ACLU president also argues that President Obama has relied on secrecy to maintain these laws, just as his predecessor did. She discusses her findings with former Assistant Attorney General and Georgetown Law Professor, Viet Dan. Susan Herman, the tenured professor of law at Brooklyn Law School and for the last 3 years president of ACLU. You have written a very good, very well-written, and very clear compilation of a number of stories that have transpired over the last decade as America responded to the threat of continuing threat of terrorism after 9/11. The book is very timely. It is out this week, this month. It's called Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of American Democracy. Now, right-thinking Americans would naturally differ regarding the activities and the consequences of terrorism and our responses to it. I think what is really important is that
But we know the facts, and we know the stories behind the facts. And I think that you've accomplished a tremendous feat of telling the stories very clearly, dispassionately, while at the same time not losing your advocate's edge. After all, you are the president of ACLU. So I thought we might start just simply by talking about some of these stories that you have compiled here, the stories of ordinary Americans, sometimes not so ordinary activities, and the responses and the systems they find themselves into.
Well, thank you, Dad. Those comments on the book mean a lot to me. I wrote this book, as you say, because I think that most Americans aren't really aware of the fact that the kinds of policies that we started after 9/11 often do have costs that people aren't really aware of. And people sometimes know the individual stories I've been talking about. But I thought it was important to say put them all together so that you can really draw themes and see patterns. So in the first chapter, I call the chapter The Webmaster and the Football Player because it's about two men, one of whom is an American citizen and the other of whom is not.
Both Midwestern college students.
Idaho.
I'm in Idaho. Right.
So they had met at the University of Idaho. The first gentleman was a man named Samuel Hussein. He was a Saudi exchange student. He was going to Idaho, a land grant school, because he was studying computer studies. And while he was there, he was a Muslim, not surprisingly, being from Saudi Arabia. And 9/11 took place, and he was somebody who led a candlelight vigil to protest that people were beginning to associate Muslims with radical jihad and 9/11. And he really wanted people to understand that that is not the most of Islam, that most Muslims are very peace-loving people. So he was working with an organization called the Islamic Assembly of North America, and they, too, were trying to get people to understand more about Islam. And because he was a computer person, he served as their webmaster. And one of the things that he did on their website, because they were trying to get people off of the information so that they could need to find out more, as if they get all the facts about Islam, was he posted links to various things that people had written, including links of people explaining why they thought jihad was a good idea. The whole range of all kinds of links. So at some point, he came under investigation by the FBI, and they did after a lot of wiretaps, a lot of electronic surveillance, even his email, et cetera. They didn't really come up with a lot of evidence that he was, in fact, part of the sleeper cell in Idaho that they thought. They had discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the story is really about.
Was there such a super cell?
No, evidently not. I think they just thought there was. And to me, this is a story about how when you think you have something, your people of good faith, government agents of good faith, can start reasoning backwards and jumping to conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought, you know, partially because he was making donations to Muslim charities, because
mm-hmm.
that's part of what it means to be a Muslim,
mm-hmm.
and they just thought that they had found a sleeper cell in Idaho. So they end up prosecuting Samuel Hussein for material support of terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And what he had done, really, his action was to post these links on the website.
Mm-hmm.
Now the
FBI affidavit and the charging document alleged that he had facilitated the recruitment of terrorists
right.
through the dissemination of their propaganda through the internet, and also attempted to or actually tried to solicit funds for these terror organizations through his own contributions to the charity. Did he solicit funds?
One of the facts that was alleged against him in the trial was that, in fact, there was a link to some other website where you could get it, make a contribution to the terrorist.
Right.
His lawyer pointed out at trial that link had been disabled before he was involved with the project. His contributions for charities were not to anything on the blacklist. There was really no showing that he was supporting terrorism himself.
Right.
And in fact, the FBI's theory began to shift during the case as they went along. At first, they said he was supporting Al-Qaeda. Then they said, no, it was Hamas. Then they said, no, it was Chechen rebels. So what it came down to at the trial was the only concrete evidence of anything he had actually done that could remotely be imagined that he was supporting terrorism was that he had made it possible for people to read ideas. And people might then be convinced of the ideas and decide to support terrorists.
And he contributed material support to the terrorism effort by providing
the link
to
That's
the
it.
Other websites, which
That's
he had no part in creating.
He had no part in creating the other websites.
And the government concedes that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that, in fact, this organization that he was working with, the Islamic Assembly, was not on any blacklist. Nobody suspected them of anything.
Mm-hmm.
So what it came down to, as his lawyer was arguing to the district court, that he was really just being prosecuted for speech.
Now let me ask you a question. The end link, the one that supports jihad, that as the basis of his support for the material, for terrorism. Was that link hosted by a group that is designated on a blacklist or something?
I'm not even sure what link they were talking about, because in the end, the government didn't connect him with that link.
Mm-hmm.
And just the fact that, you know, somebody else had a link to a link, you know, how can you prosecute him
right.
for supporting terrorism? What his lawyer told the jury, actually his lawyer did make a motion to dismiss the case, but the judge didn't do that. And the lawyer argued to the jury that if you could prosecute Sami al-Hussein for posting links to the speech of jihadists, you could prosecute the New York Times for posting an editorial by members of Hamas saying this is why we believe what we believe.
Mm-hmm.
And what I thought was really fascinating was that, you know, we think of Idaho as a pretty conservative state, and the jurors in this case were pretty typical Idaho residents. One was a retired forest worker. And after thinking about the First Amendment and what the government was arguing, the jury, in very rapid time, acquitted him.
Right.
And one of the jurors said, you know, this is just about people talking. It's about them saying what they think and enabling other people to talk. It's about conversation.
Yeah, the First Amendment protection for the New York Times is a very interesting and analogy and argument. Why did the judge reject that in the motion for summary judgment?
Well,
it seems to be a fairly straightforward constitutional carve-out.
We actually don't know the answer to that question. The good man and the lawyer who was representing him told me that the judge had said, declining to dismiss the case, the judge said an opinion would follow, but he said no opinion ever followed.
Right.
So, you know, unfortunately, you know, we hope that judges are going to act as gatekeepers here. And what I think is wonderful, a kind of tribute to the American Constitution, is that it was the right to jury trial that really came into play there, and the jurors did acquit Sami al-Hussein of that charge.
Well, but one way to distinguish the posting of the link to let's just for the sake of argument, clearly and visibly jihadist the website from the New York Times op-ed being signed by Hamas, clearly a designated terrorist organization under our system, is that the posting of links is more like the passing out of leaflets, you know, facilitating the message of the jihadist website rather than being a publication, being a true First Amendment purveyor like the New York Times. Could that be what the judge was thinking about?
Well, I don't know what the judge was thinking, but it seems to me that the Internet is, as you think, a little different from the newspaper. But if anybody can be prosecuted for speaking, including the New York Times on its own website, you know, they have a hyperlink that can be hyperlinked to something else.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, it seems to me it's just not consistent with our First Amendment ideas that people have the right to listen to all kinds of speech and make up their own minds. For the government to have the theory that this was making it too easy for people to confront ideas that then might lead them down a path to someplace else.
What about the material support aside from the speech activities? What about the material support that the government alleged with respect to its own contributions or the contributions he sought for others?
Well, the jury didn't think that the government had made out the case. But let me tell you, I mean, you're looking at, properly as a lawyer and as a former prosecutor, at what the government alleged. I interviewed, you know, people who were on the Idaho campus at the time, and nobody ever believed that Sami al-Hussein was a terrorist. They thought the government had really just misunderstood,
right,
and, you know, kind of had gotten misled. Everybody said he was the gentlest person. One person said it was like a War of the Worlds hoax. They just could not believe that he was involved in this. Plus, the other thing that happened in this case was that he was arrested. I think it was 4 a.m. It was 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. when about 100 federal troops stormed the campus. And in addition to arresting Sami al-Hussein on this charge, plus immigration violations,
mm-hmm.
they also interrogated all of the people they called Sami's associates, all the other Arab and Muslim students at Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And it terrified people. And there was everybody in the town, apparently, liberals and libertarians alike, were pretty horrified afterwards. At the time, the government was saying, oh, we found a secret cell in Idaho. And I think it was just a mistake. It was your wishful thinking that, you know, that you could find something.
And the other associates were not charged.
No.
And just to close the chapter on Mr. Hussein, he was acquitted of the material support charges.
He was acquitted of the
material
support charges.
But he was convicted of the immigration violation.
He was not convicted. He was a mistrial. The jury hung on whether or not he had violated immigration law. And the theory of that was that he was not genuinely a student because he was also working with the Islamic Assembly of North America.
Oh,
he was always on paid work, so they said he was violating, you know, that he wasn't really a student. But just to give you an example of
right.
the kind of the wishful thinking that goes on in back to Disney, one thing that one agent said was suspicious, their theory was that he wasn't a serious student and that he was only in the country because he was really a terrorist and he was pretending to be a student. So one agent, I think it was, pointed to the fact that he switched his dissertation advisor in the middle of the year. They said, well, that's suspicious. Nobody does that. That must mean he's not serious about his dissertation. Mm-hmm. Turned out, you know, Dad looked harder. His advisor had cancer. Mm-hmm. And he had 6 advisors because he was trying so hard to finish his dissertation.
Right.
And he was almost through when the FBI entered his life. He ended up in jail. He ended up, you know, agreeing to go back to Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
They shipped away his wife and his children while he was standing trial.
Right.
They wouldn't let them stay in the country. And it was a pretty horrific experience. I can tell you where he is now. He's in Saudi Arabia, scratching his head, trying to mesh what happened to him with his lifelong concept that America is the land of the just and the true.
Right. So notwithstanding the mistrial, he voluntarily agreed to be removed from the country.
He did, because
family.
That's it, because his family had already, you know, gone back there and he's part of what happened.
And he continued his education.
Well, he was never able to finish his dissertation.
Right.
Because he was inches away, and that's in fact what he was doing in his jail cell. He was locked, I think, in solitary for about 17 months.
Right.
While his family is, you know, back in Saudi Arabia, and he was trying to work on his dissertation.
Right. So you mentioned throughout the story that the FBI was working backwards,
right,
and thinking backwards.
Yes.
And certainly the jury to agree that that he should be acquitted of these charges. How did he come to the attention of the FBI or the investigators, regardless of what mistakes they made? How did he, what were the initial red flags that raised their suspicion?
Well, it seems that some of it was that he was making contributions to Muslim charity. But, of course, as you know, that's one of the pillars of Islam, to donate to charity.
Religious obligation.
But let me give you a different example from one of the other stories I tell of what I mean by reasoning backwards. Another story I tell, which is, I think, a little more familiar to people than Samuel Hussein, is the story of Brandon Mayfield, the Oregon lawyer,
mm-hmm,
who ended up being suspected of the train bombing in Madrid because his fingerprints were similar, the fingerprints that were found on a plastic bag in Madrid.
Right, right.
Okay,
right.
So the agents looked at this. And, you know,
it's
Murphy's
Law in investigation. Right?
You know,
if you look at it, it's probably one of the most horrendous mistakes you've ever done back in an investigation. You go back and you say, how can you possibly connect a white lawyer in Oregon with a bombing in Madrid? And then you look at it and you look at it from the lens of the FBI agent who was making the connection.
Right.
And you know, you can see how those mistakes happen. That helped Brandon Mayfield.
But here's how the mistakes happen. Two things. First of all, when the FBI identified the fingerprints, one agent said, oh, that fingerprint is a lot like that fingerprint. What you should be doing then, and what the FBI is doing now, after hundreds of pages of Inspector General reports, is
right,
to have a second person who doesn't know that
right,
the first person made the identification do that independently. But that didn't happen. So later people all assumed that the first identification was right. When they told the Spaniards said, no, we don't think so, and nobody paid any attention. They never asked the Spaniards
right,
what the basis of their conclusion was. So that was one problem. But to
give an idea, we have a sense in the public that, you know, that forensic science and fingerprinting in particular has been around for a century, is a precise science.
Right.
It is precise science in the sense that each of our fingerprints is unique, and matching
right,
another fingerprint is unique. However, the match is anything but a science. You know, it depends on how many points you compare it to, how similar they are in terms of the match. That's why the physical comparison comes into play, where there's not a perfect match.
Well, I think that's right. You're right. Is that, of course, it's an art, matching fingerprints, and that's one thing that, again, looking backwards, you can tell about the NATO case. So again, you know, aside from the sloppy forensic practices of not having independent verification, once the agents thought that Brandon Mayfield was in fact involved in this bombing, they're reasoning backwards from therefore, you know, what must have happened.
Right.
So Brandon Mayfield didn't have a passport. He was an Army veteran and hadn't been out of the country, and he didn't have a passport. So they're thinking, well, how could he have gotten to Madrid if he didn't have a passport? So they thought, oh, he must have had a fake passport. So they submit an affidavit to the judge saying, we want to arrest him as a material witness to find out what's going on, because we don't think we really have probable cause to charge him at the time. And one of the reasons that we are telling you that we suspect him is there's a likelihood that he had a phony passport.
Right, right.
Now, that's
just to give the context, you know, there is a lot of reasoning backwards here. I mean, you're absolutely right. But Brandon Mayfield is not just some lawyer sitting in Oregon. He is a lawyer that's known to the FBI and the Justice Department, only for legitimate reasons. He had defended one of the 9/11 defendants.
No, he actually represented Jeffrey Battle, who was one of the people in Oregon, and he represented
right,
him in a child custody case.
Right, right, right.
And
now,
you know,
Jeffrey
every
Battle,
lawyer is
right,
suspicious because they represent somebody in a child custody case.
Right.
Yeah,
and Jeffrey Battle is
was a gentleman in Oregon who ended up being charged with, you know, terrorism crimes.
With terrorism.
And that was
at least within the universe.
So that's a pretty big universe. And part of the problem
is it is a big universe, but when you can see how a fingerprint, which is questionable in of itself, suddenly triggers red flags and starts this whole process of reverse reasoning, as you
were. But the process of reverse reasoning, I think the other thing that your comment suggests to me is that the reverse reasoning in this case was also affected by a real anti-Muslim bias. So one of the things that the agent found suspicious that was charged is that Brendan advertised his legal business in what they called the Muslim Yellow Pages.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what Wealthy mentioned to the jury was the Muslim Yellow Pages also advertised as Western and Avis and Hertz. You know, there's really nothing suspicious about representing people who are Muslim.
Did the FBI agent put this in the affidavit applying for the material witness warrant?
Yeah, for the material witness warrant. So it wasn't what initially led to the fingerprint identification.
Right.
After the identification, in fact, Brendan's religion, he converted to Islam. He's a veteran and ended up converting to Islam.
Right. Before or after his experiences and the tribulations? Yeah.
Oh, no, that was before.
That was
before. One reason why he was being suspected.
Right.
And
it
did figure heavily because he was a
Muslim
American.
Right. And that was put into the affidavit.
Yes. His religious practices. That was considered to be suspicious.
And the judge granted the material witness.
The
warrant he was held was dismissed in prison.
I don't remember how many months. It was after a period of time. I don't recall exactly what the period was before he was, but that was just as a material witness.
Right.
And I think, again, the problem, as the Inspector General concluded, was that the judge was not given enough information to really assess the facts because the agents had been really leaping to conclusions.
Right.
They bounced ahead.
Right.
And what I think is the most troubling part of this story is when the Spaniard police said, we think you're wrong, that nobody ever listened.
And you mentioned that the after the Inspector General report, the FBI now has procedures in place in order to hopefully prevent or at least the double check.
Right, to be more careful about double checking and verify the fingerprint. So that's that particular problem. Maybe that wouldn't happen as much.
You have to go to third and partial.
Of course, but I think what's more concerning is the way that the FBI was willing to believe that Brandon Mayfield was involved, I think, partially on the basis of his religion, like Samuel is saying. He's a Muslim. He's from Saudi Arabia. He's contributing to Muslim charities. And that raises too many red flags by itself. Let me tell you another person who was connected. This is the other part of my chapter.
Right, and so now it comes back full circle, at least at the other triangle. One of the associates that the FBI interview of Samia Hussein on that evening in Idaho is a football player who was subsequently also arrested as a terrorist, just like Brendan Mayfield. Tell me the story. Pick it up from Samia Hussein and talk us through the Al-Kid arrest.
Okay. One of the people who Samia Hussein happened to know at Idaho was another young man who had converted to Islam, and this person, like Brendan Mayfield, is an American citizen. He was born in Kansas. His name was Luvoni Tewkid, of an African-American family. His father worked in prisons, and his mother, I can't remember what his mother did, but she worked for IBM or something, isn't it? And his grandfather is a Pentecostal minister.
Mm-hmm.
So while he was in college, he was apparently a great football player. I have a great picture of him in his football uniform in the book. And he won an award for rushing, he was just a really good football player. But while he was in college, as often people do in college, he started to rethink his religious beliefs and decided to convert to Islam. Now, his grandfather's minister wasn't that happy. He had been chosen a church, but still appreciated that he was being a religious person. So the government's investigation of Samuel Hussein, because they were interested in everybody else who they thought might be involved in this non-existent sleeper cell, extended to Abdullah al-Qaeda because he was a Muslim. And so somebody along the way really hypothesized that he, too, was part of the sleeper cell, but they didn't have enough evidence to arrest him. And because, unlike Samuel Hussein, he was not an immigrant, they couldn't arrest him for immigration violations because he was a citizen. So what they did instead was they arrested him as a material witness. Now, as you know, the material witness statute allows somebody to be taken into custody if they have really important testimony to give at a trial or a legal proceeding, and if there's good reason to believe that they're going to abscond and then they won't be available as a witness.
Right. So what was the government, and all of this has to be presented to the judge, obviously, to deprive in some way of their liberty.
And the judge has to make an independent, impartial decision as to whether or not, one, this person really does have material information to give to the court in the criminal prosecution, and second, whether there is a real likelihood that he would flee the country or otherwise not cooperate with the truth-seeking process. And so what was the government's assertion with both with respect to both halves?
Okay, in terms of the first half, what would he have said? Well, we don't know because he never testified anywhere. He was never called to testify. I think that that document is not public. You know, he'd never been allowed to see what was actually in the allegations. But the best we can tell is that there was a federal agent in Spokane who, after the trial, said, well, what they thought he should testify about was on the charge of whether or not Samuel Hussein was working,
right,
as opposed to he had just being a student. But he was never called, so we don't know what he would have said.
Right.
On the cooperation, the FBI had talked to Abdullah Al-Sid. He changed his name from Livoni Sid to Abdullah Al-Sid when he converted. So they had talked to him while they were doing their investigation, and he had been fully cooperative. He offered to help out the agents by giving them lessons in Islam,
mm-hmm,
to try to help them better understand, you know, what Muslims were up to and what they thought. And he was being completely cooperative. He then had decided, because he'd become very interested in Islam, to do graduate study work in Saudi Arabia. So when he was arrested, he was at the airport, Dulles Airport, on his way to Saudi Arabia to continue his study, and all of a sudden he's arrested.
How many days after the arrest of Samuel Hussein is he in Dulles Airport? Do you remember?
So I don't recall what the relative timing is. I'm sorry, I'm sure I have the dates in the book.
Right,
I don't recall off the top of my head.
Right. What
the
relative timing is. I think it's a little detailed.
It's sometimes hard to just place the dates. But anyway, he was held in custody for 16 days, and he was shipped around the country and shackled from prison to prison. And it was clear he was not being held as a material witness because, in fact, I believe it was Robert Mueller who reported to Congress that, you know, in fact, the FBI had had great success in arresting terrorists, and Abdullah Al-Sid was one of them.
Right.
He was kept in the same cell as John Walker Lynn. And it was perfectly clear that he had not been arrested because they wanted his testimony. He had been arrested because they thought he was a terrorist and didn't have the evidence to arrest him because they just didn't have probable cause.
And after 15 days.
After 15 days. He's released, but he's released on a number of very stringent conditions. He has to stay with his in-laws. He's not allowed to travel beyond a certain radius. Obviously can't continue his studies in Saudi Arabia, but ends up, you know, having problems getting a job. His family falls apart. And he was really traumatized by this whole experience.
Mm-hmm.
Never called to testify anywhere. And so as time went on, he kept having nightmares. It's a horribly upsetting experience. And he was never been charged with anything. He had never any evidence that he had ever done anything wrong. So he finally decided to bring a lawsuit against John Ashcroft for using the material witness statute as a pretext,
mm-hmm,
for arresting him.
Right.
And it ended up, that case ended up being dismissed. It went up to the Supreme Court, and it was dismissed against John Ashcroft on the ground that he was immune. However, you know, in connection with the Brandon Mayfield case, there were connections because the affidavit that was actually given to the court for the material witness arrest that had been filled out by various FBI agents also has some very misleading things to say. For example, one reason why they said they think he's going to respond is they said he bought a $5,000 first-class one-way ticket to Saudi Arabia. He hadn't. He had bought a $1,700 round-trip ticket to Saudi Arabia. And what wasn't mentioned was that he had a family, a wife and children in the United States, that he's offered the FBI his cooperation. So that part of the lawsuit continues against the FBI agents for being very Machiavellian. They clearly thought that the end and disrupting what they thought was a secret bill was going to justify the means of being highly misleading in their affidavit.
Now, there's a good, interesting segue into the more the broader aspect of these various stories, which are very compelling in themselves. And, and regardless what you think about how believable and what the evidence ultimately leads, but it's hard to go away with these things, with these cases, and thinking that people were not mistreated. And so I think that's clear in your approach.
If I could just tell you that in 1 minute of attention before you continue with the thought, Abdullah Al-Sid also had serious allegations that he had been mistreated while he was incarcerated. He, in fact, ended up having a lawsuit settled for just the conditions under which he was being held and his treatment.
Right, but that was not part of the lawsuit.
No, it wasn't part of the same lawsuit. Mm-hmm. That was a separate lawsuit, and that had been settled.
Right. But in dismissing the lawsuit against Attorney General Ashcroft,
right,
for the pretext,
right,
and the claim is a good one, which is, hey, whatever you may believe I know, and whatever Congress believe I am I should be on my legal obligations under material support statute. You can't use it as a pretext in order to hold me for other grounds. That is, you know, if I'm speeding, pull me over. Speeding, don't pull me over for a broken taillight, as it were. You know, really a classic pretext argument. The court rejected this, and Justice Scalia wrote that the efficient and fair administration of justice requires us to focus on the facts as they are at the time of the decision, that is the time that the judge granted the material witness warrant, not on the motive of the arresting officer, because otherwise we would know the law can be broken and we would always question the motives of the arresting officer. Sounds to me a fairly reasonable sort of macro systemic rule of law. And so, despite the perceived injustice in the application in one particular aspect, you know, we're looking at a systemic level, that's not right, don't you think?
No, I don't. I'm sorry to have to disagree, but I think Justice Scalia has been wrong about this for a long time. He gives the opinions that I disagree with.
I'm not surprised.
The opinions I disagree with, and it doesn't really matter if you're being arrested on a pretext. But even given those opinions as to ordinary officers, the Attorney General making this policy and inviting law enforcement officers around the country to use the material witness statute where they really never had any intention of calling someone as a witness, I think that's a different matter. And I think that what troubles me is not just what happened to Samuel Hussein and what happened to Abdullah al-Sid. Samuel Hussein was really confronting the First Amendment, and this was trying to do an end run around the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment says you can't arrest people unless you have probable cause. And if the chief law enforcement agency in the country is saying to everybody, but it's okay because you can pretend, you just use this as a pretext, I think that's a lot more serious than an individual officer pulling you over for a broken taillight when they really want to see if you have drugs.
But what about the independent and intervening action of the judiciary? That is, initially, of the judge who approves the material witness.
But the problem there, again, and that's the real problem, one reason why the case was dismissed against John Ashcroft was that John Ashcroft was not personally implicated in all the misleading information that was put into this affidavit. The ACLU, which was representing Abdullah al-Sid, had the theory that the judge never would have issued that warrant if he had been told the actual facts. You see, I don't recall who it was. But if in fact they'd been given the whole picture and told that Abdullah was perfectly willing to cooperate with the FBI, if they'd called him to testify, he would have testified. He wasn't running away from that.
Who was representing Abdullah al-Sid at the material witness warrant here? Because he doesn't have a theory on
him. I'm sorry, I don't recall.
Right,
yeah,
right.
I'm mostly familiar with the case from after the fact, when
he was
representing
right.
him and his challenge.
So one answer is we should be much more vigilant at whatever the issues, whatever our differences of opinion are on the use of the proper use of the material witness, the statute, or secondary liability for misuse, or alleged misuse of it. The one lesson is that we should be much more vigilant, we being the system, the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense attorney, to be much more vigilant in testing the underlying factual bases for such a material witness warrant, so because the consequences are pretty dramatic. You can be put in jail for at least up to a year without possibility of bail, essentially.
Well, I think that's
and people forget, you know, people the thing was always just a material witness warrant. The effect is the same.
It is and horrible experience. But I think it's certainly true that we do want to be more careful about how we use all these enormous powers, like the material witness arrest and the prosecution of Samuel Hussein for materially supporting terrorists that this was not based on very much. Because it's one thing to say, okay, we have these enormous dragnet powers, but we're just going to use them really carefully. To me, that's not enough of an answer. Once you set in place the dragnet, once you say, we're going to allow the Attorney General to say we can use a material witness arrest warrant to arrest somebody as a to get around the fact that we don't have probable cause to arrest them. That in itself is a problem. I think it just invites abuse, it invites abuse of discretion in different forms. And the prosecution of Samuel Hussein, you know, a lot of people, I think that there's nothing wrong with giving the government these enormous dragnet powers, and the material support laws are enormous powers. They'll allow prosecution of humanitarians, of the New York Times, of all sorts of people. It's one thing to say, let's be careful not to prosecute people in a way that violates the First Amendment. But the mere existence of a statute that invites prosecution or allows prosecution to people for giving humanitarian aid to someone the government thinks is a terrorist or for posting links on a website, it seems to me it has a chilling effect. People start worrying about, what, you know, should I really check out the biography of Osama bin Laden? What if the government becomes suspicious of me?
Well, the support statute is clear. There has to be either a designated terrorist organization
or
an organization or a specific intent to give to terrorism. And so, you're right. And we don't know, ordinary citizens don't ordinarily know what the organization are listed under Section 319. But you can give this, you can take it as fairly good given that if you're giving money to a designated terrorist organization, you should be punished because the United States government has
they're not just talking about giving money to a terrorist organization. The material support laws were vastly expanded after the Patriot Act, and one of the things that's prohibited is providing expert advice or assistance to terrorists. It used to be, it looked like it was money or guns. Now, expert advice or assistance can include humanitarian aid. That was an exception that was specifically left out. So that means, for example, there was an ACLU lawyer who was from Sri Lanka. He went home for vacation. While he was in Sri Lanka, to see relatives, while he was there, the tsunami came. At the time of the tsunami, a fifth of Sri Lanka was being controlled by the LTTE, the Tamil Tigers. Therefore, if he were a relief organization and he wanted to give food to those people who had been affected by the tsunami, he had to deal with the LTTE because they were the government for a fifth of the country.
And the Department of Justice position is that whatever money that the LTTE or whatever the other organization does not spend on the refugee camps, it can spend on guns because the money is fungible. And so we will have a constitutional carve out for First Amendment activities or other activities that the government cannot prosecute as a matter of law. But otherwise, money is fungible.
It's not only support is fungible. The Supreme Court has made the First Amendment carve out enormous. So here's another example. There was a group called the Humanitarian.
Let's hold the Humanitarian Project because we will go to that discussion because that was a decision last year by the Supreme Court interpreting exactly this provision regarding. Regarding the constitutional reach of the statute,
right.
We'll do that right after the break.
Good.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank
you.
On the Go, Afterwards is available via podcast through iTunes and XML. Visit booktv.org and click podcast on the upper left side of the page. Select which podcast you'd like to download and listen to afterwards while you travel.
Susan Herman, the president of ACLU and professor at Brooklyn Law School. The book is Taking Liberties, The War on Terror, and the Erosion of American Democracy. We were talking about the material support statute and the criminal prohibition therefrom. The giving money to a designated terrorist organization is illegal. The statute has been expanded to include non-monetary aid, including expert advice and assistance, including providing your own efforts rather than recruiting others. Your own effort in rendering expert advice and assistance is enough in order to fall within the ambit of this statute. The question is, what if you give money or assistance to non-terrorist activities of a designated terrorist organization? A case that came down last year, Humanitarian Law Project, that money is fungible, so therefore giving money to one part of a designated organization is supporting another part of terrorist activity.
The problem with that theory is that this goes way beyond money. The Humanitarian Law Project wasn't giving money to anybody. And I think that the central idea of the material support laws, if you're giving money or guns to terrorists, that's a crime. Of course that's a crime. But it's also a crime of conspiracy and attempt. It was a crime anyway. And the statute is different just too much. So let me give you a couple of different examples. The Humanitarian Law Project were a group of people who were really interested in promoting peace. And one of the things that they set out to do was to try to talk potential terrorists or terrorist groups out of committing acts of terrorism by showing them how they could use peaceful dispute resolution techniques, like going to the UN, with their grievances. So So the humanitarian law project was working with the Kurds in Turkey. Now, as you know, the Kurds in Turkey have had many grievances with the Turkish government. And so what they were trying to explain to people was that instead of the attorney's terrorism, there were other ways that they could really get their grievances addressed. When the Patriot Act expanded the material and support laws to go way beyond money or guns to provide to cover any sort of expert advice or assistance, they started to worry about whether they could be subject to prosecution, whether they were having a problem telling their donors to support them, whether the donors would be considered to be supporting an effort that was getting too close to terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
So after many years of litigation back and forth in the California federal courts, the case ended up in the Supreme Court. And to my great dismay, the Supreme Court said, well, you know, doesn't violate the First Amendment.
Right.
They said, you know, first of all, yes, the stat expert advice and assistance is broad enough, that term is broad enough to cover telling the terrorist not to be a terrorist. And then in answer to the question, well, what about the First Amendment? The court said, well, you know, okay, this is preventing people from speaking, but whether you can speak depends on what you want to say. And Congress's theory in this statute is terrorists have to be radioactive. And so their theory was, you know, this isn't money that's fungible because there wasn't any money. And to me, the court's answer was really rather far-fetched. They said, well, you know, okay, the valuable service here is training and using alternate dispute resolution methods. So if the terrorists don't have to come up with their own training and using dispute resolution methods, that frees up resources to use elsewhere. But did it give some legitimacy? Yeah, to me, this is really terrifying. So let me tell you one step further. At the oral argument, Elaine Kagan was at that time Solicitor General, so she was arguing the case, and I'm sure this is not an answer she thought up on the spur of the moment. One of the justices said to her, so if the statute is broad enough to cover the humanitarian law project to try to teach terrorists not to be terrorists, could that also cover a lawyer filing a brief on behalf of a terrorist group or a terrorist?
Which was one of the facts in the case itself in one of the earlier iterations.
And she said, yes, it would cover lawyers.
Right.
Now, I think that's just too broad. The idea that the government just has this power over everybody. Do I think that Barack Obama is going to prosecute lawyers or the Red Cross or Eric Holder? No, I don't. But I think this has a tremendous skill. And I think
And one thing, just to be fair, I mean, I do agree that the statute is very broad. I mean,
very
extraordinarily broad.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court recognizes this. It just says this is about as broad a statute as it has to be.
Right.
Nevertheless, it is just not to be fair. I think it was unconstitutional on its face. To be fair, if there are unconstitutional applications, if indeed it is used in order to punish speech, if it is used in order to punish unconstitutional conduct, the unconstitutionality of that application is always a defense to the unjust.
One could always raise the First Amendment defense. That did not work so well for Samuel Hussein. The judge denied it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that segment. Certainly, Professor Furman has thought a lot about this, and the book is interesting. I haven't read it, but now you've got a tip about it. If you'd like to read it yourself, you can go ahead and take a look at the book called Taking Liberties, or you can listen to the rest of the show. You're missing about 20 minutes of it if you want to pick it up off of booktv.org. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight in the show. Take a look at the billing, see if we're going to be doing next week. I usually set that up sometime early in the week next week, and we're now going to have Vera Lynn sing her wonderful song, We'll Meet Again.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again, don't know where. Don't know what.